This is an Asian Pop Radio podcast. Hear more by subscribing to Asian Pop Radio on iTunes or head to asianpopradio.com to see more.
Dee Huynh, welcome to Asian Pop Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Firstly, I'd like to maybe get started by asking you where exactly in the beautiful country of Vietnam your family are from.
Right. So, our family are 3 hours drive south of Ho Chi Minh City. So, we're at the very end of the Mekong Delta. So, it's a little shanty town. And the image of it that I recall was that it was this dusty, uncemented road. And when I went back even just to a couple of years ago, it's still, that dusty little uncemented road, so and tiny little streets and a little shanty town with a market at the end. Yeah.
It sounds, maybe, I think I might have been there. I think I went to Vietnam the first time 10 years ago, and it's only like really close to the Cambodian border. Is that right?
Yep.
So at the end of the day, the sun's going down and there's a lot of sort of mess around the market and everything in the street.
And the noise, and that's, I stayed at a hotel right on the river, and just the sound, it's this kind of, clacking of things happening and the motorboats, churning up. And
it's a unique sound, isn't it?
It is a unique sound.
There are sounds that you hear in Vietnam that you can't hear anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Mostly like beeping and, tooting of horns in the morning and prayers and all sorts of stuff all mixed in one. It's an amazing place.
And smells. Yeah. So,
yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And how, for those that are unaware, like how special is the Mekong River? Like what part does it play in Vietnam's history?
Well, I mean, I guess it's been a source of food and the travel that we used to be able to carry stuff from the north down, and so it runs the kind of a good length of the country. So it's a sort, obviously people fish in it, and you might get your handful of prawns and have food for the day. So it's a sort of a subsistence living type thing that's facilitated for centuries.
So much of Vietnam's built on just being able to access from north and south through the water.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so it's a beautiful country, and if you haven't been, it's worthwhile.
There is nothing like being on a boat down the Mekong in the sun and just doing the Aussie thing, having lots of drinks while you do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the British thing, or the American thing. Reading a story on the Baguette website, your father was one of a very big family, right?
Yeah, he had the 9 children in his family.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big family. And at the time, I guess in that era, people had a lot of children, just because, I don't know, I think that...
There was no Netflix.
No Netflix, and
but just chill.
There's also a greater need for it as well, because the more children were kind of like your workhorses, your assets, your investments into the future. They're the ones that are going to look after you. But unfortunately, his father died when he was quite young, and so, with 9 families, single mother, my grandmother sent the children out to work. So, dad was out there selling bread from, he bought from the local bakery and delivered them to the village.
Yeah,
and he would make a little bit of a margin. But what that did was there was a handful of coins that he could swap for rice, and that would feed the family for the day. So, that's how day to day we think that we struggle with our bills in this day and age.
Yeah, we complain about everything.
We
complain
about everything. They have,
their real struggles.
Really, feed. We don't have to worry about when our next meal is, whether we're going to get our next meal. They had very clear concerns whether they're going to have food. So
amazing. That must have been quite a toll on your grandma.
Yeah.
A bit of a no-brainer, but then to kind of pull up her socks and go, well, we're going to have to make this work.
Yeah, she's a very strong woman. Like, she's very, she was. I mean, she's passed away now, but she, I remember her just like this kind of core. I guess the image that we see sometimes in the West is the old Italian grandmas. She was a bit one of those. And she's an equivalent of that. But, and maybe more tough on the kids than she should have been, but very, very industrious. And so, so that's how the banh mi phenomenon happened. And of course, the French were in Vietnam at the time, and they brought their charcuterie and their pâtés, and grandma thought, okay, well, he's delivering bread to the village, so why don't we just fill them and add value to this basic product,
Sure.
And so
knowing you can put a bit of a markup on that.
Yeah, so it became more valuable than the 5 cent, markup that dad would put on, equivalent of 5 cent was that day and age. So that's when sort of the first fusion of the French food and Vietnamese flavors came. So you got your charcuterie and your pâtés and stuff. And then grandma put, pickled carrots and daikon.
Oh, wow.
coriander and chili in there, and you know, with a little bit of soy sauce, and sent that off on the way, and that's the origin of banh mi. So
really,
yeah.
So no one else was doing that.
No, well, I mean, there obviously there would have been some sort of evolution.
Yeah, yeah,
you
know, yeah.
I mean, I don't think grandma was the first to do it, but there was, yeah.
Thereabouts that time.
Around about that time, yeah. So,
wow, so your grandma was a pretty amazing entrepreneur.
Yeah, yeah. And
if you're in, back in those days, and your father, you know, the husband's the breadwinner.
That's right.
And she's probably at home looking after her 9 children. Yeah, yeah. Where did she learn to be such a go-getter like that?
I think that there's a kind of an entrepreneurial streak in Vietnamese culture in general, yeah. I think, and that just comes from necessity.
Yeah.
You know? So, you've just got to think of ways that you could turn something, you know, basic into money, like to feed yourself. So, it comes from necessity rather than entrepreneurialism as such. So, yeah.
It's hard to get stuff started, isn't it? Like, anyone I talk to that tries to start a business, it's hard to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
But your grandma did it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've kept all of her recipes, and you know, I remember sort of even as a kid, I remember, you know, going over to her little baguette stand and stealing her food, and mum telling me off and that I shouldn't be doing that, you know. And so so I do have sort of a hazy memory of that,
yeah,
because our family left Vietnam, you know, shortly after that, through the whole refugee boat era. So
let's talk about that. Your mother and father moved to Australia at about what time was that?
So
70s,
early
I'm assuming.
80s.
Early 80s. Okay.
I recall we were piled onto a little fishing boat, and I think 150 people piled into a small fishing boat, end to end, like little sardines. And
how old were you at the time?
4.
Wow.
My brother was 3. And
so, they're your earliest memories, yeah. Really, are they? Do you remember much before then?
Not really. So,
So that's lasting stuff, isn't it?
Shady. But that's really clear. You know, there's just strange things that when you've got, you know, a bit of trauma or whatever.
Yeah. Mine was burning my finger playing with matches when I was 4. Okay. You lived through something a little bit more traumatic.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, everything's traumatic, and you remember those sort of memories really clearly. So,
what do you remember? Like, how long the journey was? What were some of the things that stand out?
I remember the smell of the boat.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, you know, you can't get out to go to the bathroom, and there's people were sick and hadn't been in a boat, you know, particularly underground. I remember the pirates, Malaysian pirates at sea, you know, ripping the teeth out of an old man because that was the only bit of gold that was on the
board.
Anything of value, stealing the women. I remember the men running around with, you know, sooty pots and spreading it on their wives just to mask, you know, what they look like so that wouldn't be chosen, you know. So I was really aware of why that was all happening even at that age. So so a difficult time, and you know, we were on at sea for 7 to 10 days. We lost count, the days kind of merged together, but
and I'm sure they felt a lot longer than 7 days.
Oh yeah. The boat finally collapsed and we washed ashore on a Malaysian coast, and luckily we were one of the few who had all of our family intact. Not many from that journey actually could say that.
So much of our, especially in Melbourne, our local community, the Vietnamese community is huge.
Yeah.
And I don't know about, you know, obviously not part of, you know, the Vietnamese circles in that way. But, you know, it's such a big part of our history now.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get spoken about that much, I feel.
Yeah.
Why is that? Like, why does the Vietnam War not really get spoken about? It's not really, I don't remember being taught about it at school.
Yeah, well, I think Vietnamese people in general are maybe they're more forward-looking people rather than so it's I think they've got an attitude. I feel a part of it, but sometimes I feel not a part of it because I've grown up in a slightly different culture. But I think that in general the generation of boat people that came into Australia are now sort of thinking, you know, that was in the past, and we move on. So there's a kind of resilience about the Vietnamese culture, which I'm really proud of.
So really quickly, sort of acknowledging this is where we've been, that's what's happened. Yep. Okay, acceptance, and then moving on.
Yep, that's right.
And so, growing up, did your parents speak of that journey, the war itself?
It's not so much in our family. We didn't have a strong like, let's sit down and communicate, you know, like it's very typical.
It's a bit hierarchical anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Asian culture where there's not a lot of that communication. And it wasn't really until I was an adult that I said, well, this is ridiculous. We need to talk as a family and there are things that are unresolved and we need to.
And so, you had those discussions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and broader discussions around, you know, the family unit and people's behaviors.
Because I've got Vietnamese friends that are in their 30s, 40s now, and I think they've never had those discussions with their parents and they just couldn't even find it. They wouldn't dream of finding a way to bring it up.
Yeah.
Mum and dad are still affected by it. There was no counseling.
Yeah. Well, I guess it takes a certain level of, I don't know, you got to put aside a lot of the baggage of the past. And it's psychologically, everybody has to do that at some point, regardless of what culture. And it's not specific to being a refugee or Asian that you experience that. And so, I think we all reach a point where we become adults and the relationship with the parents have to separate in a different way. So, my epiphany came, I guess, when I thought, oh, it's really, really sad that I have a really good, really open communicationship with my friendship circle and everybody that I know I can feel really comfortable to say things to.
Mm.
But yet, the people who I should be really close to, my mum and dad, I don't have that same experience with. And I said, well, you know, that's something I want to change, you know, and I'm at least 50% of the conversation. So, I'm going to pretend that they're just another friend and I'm going to talk to them like they're a friend.
It's hard to get to that shift, isn't it? Because we respect our parents and their wishes and the way they do things, and it's very hard to challenge that and do things from a different way. But I think as you get older, your relationship with your mum and your dad, instead of just yelling at them in frustration and saying, I'm going to do things differently, you find a way to kind of meet the halfway.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any good relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, you would have had that period where you transitioned from, you know, I'm not dependent anymore and I need to be, you know, independent.
Yeah.
I guess we all experience that. And with the additional dynamic of culture, it becomes a little bit more difficult as well for them. They're living a different world.
Yeah. You know,
and in a lot of ways, when I was growing up, I felt that they were in a different world than me. But now, luckily, that world, both of those worlds live.
Amazing.
Coexist really well. Really well, yeah.
So, do you think you got your good work ethic from your dad or your grandma or both?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Because you sound like a busy man. You're doing a few things.
Yeah. Well, I think that I've always grown up with the appreciation that if all goes down, you know, like everything fails, you know. I've never had a really strong attitude about failure. I've always thought, well, you know, if I fail, then what's the worst that can happen? You know, and that's the thing that sort of driven me to continue to do things that maybe others would think, oh, that seems a bit risky. Or when you reflect on the fact that you were in refugee camp eating, you know, maggots and, you know, stuff that was thrown together from the market scraps, you know, to where you are now, it won't ever be that bad again. You know, so there's a kind of a sense of perspective that being a refugee gives you. Yeah.
I once had a friend who actually used to work here, and he was Vietnamese background as well.
Yeah.
And he said to me, I remember panicking about a ridiculous thing. What if this doesn't work? And he said, What's the worst thing that could happen? Like, try and picture the worst scenario you could be in, and then how would you get out of that? Because he said he did that. He thought about the worst scenario could be in. What would he put into place to try and remove himself from that? And his worst case scenario was being in another country, no money, no phone, not being able to speak the language. How would he get out of that? And he said to himself, I know how to get out of that situation. Yeah. And if that's my worst case situation, I can get out of any situation. So, I guess it's good to put things into perspective.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And for me, that was the same experience. And I take on projects now without really a strong sense of fear of failure. And of course, you want things to go well and all of that and putting things in place. And so, learning sort of some business acumen around putting right structures around things is, you know, that's...
How often do you fail?
It depends about on your perspective. But, you know, I think failure for me is not quite meeting a target, or, you know, there's a range of things.
Yeah.
Or I haven't done enough to get the culture right at, you know, at the business that we're working in, or, you know, there's a range of ways that you can fail that is. But I sort of see that as it informs, you know, that, that something needs to be addressed in a particular area. Hmm. And I don't sort of worry that everything is collapsing, that I can address the specific part of the problem, solve that. And, you know, that's all you can do. You know, you've got, you know, a certain number of hours in the day. That's all you can get done. And you could spend an hour stressing about it if you want to, but then maybe spend a couple of hours, you know, finding a solution.
Actually doing it, yeah. Let's talk bread. tell us about the Baguette brand. What motivated you to get that started?
Well, Mum and Dad started a couple of banh mi stores in Footscray, Sunshine and St. Albans.
Are they still there today?
They're still there, yeah.
Oh, it's not the main one that everyone jumps at?
Yeah,
really?
So they started Yulang in Footscray.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
And then they started Fresh Chilli Deli in Sunshine and St. Albans.
That place has kept me going over the last 4.5 years.
Yeah, because of course you've
I go in there every time. I go in there probably once a week to get my my tofu roll and my little Nippy's chocolate milk or whatever it is.
That's Mum and Dad's place. So
there you go.
Yeah.
And for those that don't know the store, it's always about 7 people deep by about 10 people wide. Yeah. It's incredible. What an operation.
Packed with people as well. Yeah. So and lunch is always, you know, people spill out of the door. So it's so it's a really good, you know, really good business. And I'd always been in corporate, and my partner and I were living in the Gold Coast at the time. Mum and Dad said, you've got to come down and help
the people
us
need bread.
Grow the business. I said, no, that's just not really my thing, you know, like, and they said, no, you really need to look at this business. And so we did, and we thought, oh, it's actually a really good business model.
Bit, didn't you?
Yeah. And with everything that we know around structures and businesses, they thought it'd be really helpful for us to come down and apply some of that business acumen to Baguette.
Yeah.
And so we thought, so we did. And it's a sort of replicatable, you know, business that, you know, everything's produced in a production facility and then kind of assembled in store. So it's sort of replicable. And so obviously there's an opportunity to grow that. And we're just at a point where the brand's, you know, getting to a point where we want it to be. And so we might take that next step soon. Yeah.
Amazing. And so was it hard for you to get your brand off the ground?
It's food is really competitive. It's more competitive than I knew.
And they say you don't make a lot of money out of it.
Yeah, no. So the margins are very thin, and you know, we're competing with a lot of players in the market, and
you got to be quick.
City, yeah, exactly. Yeah. City, the culture, and you know, dealing with complaints, all of that sort of needs to be handled really quickly as well. It's a fast environment. You need to stay innovative. You need to shift and change menus and all of the time, and as well as keep the things that people like. So there's a lot to do. supply side, the operations, the delivery guy, how that works, and staff turnover. How do you deal with staff turnover? How do you get the right culture in place? Yeah, so all of that kind of stuff we're learning all the time. I can't say that we've got a perfect formula for it, but it's getting better.
And how many stores do you have now?
So we've got 4 stores: one in Russell Street, one Elizabeth, one in Water Gardens, and one in Werribee. So,
right.
Yeah.
And any plans to open any more anytime soon? Or?
Well, I think that's the longer term plan. And at the moment, we're just taking a quick break to expansion break to get all of the 4 stores operating the way that we want it to. And then we can push the button sort of to grow. Yeah.
When Mum goes to your restaurant, is she surprised by the quality? Is it? Does she? Does she prefer her own, or is it a bit competitive?
Mum's the QA. She still wanders through our stores, the Baguette stores. I mean, it's the family store. It's not just mine.
Yeah.
She is the matriarch that everybody fears. You know, so I've been training her. Like, I've been teaching her that she can't talk to people in physical ways, because that's actually bullying.
It's,
you know,
done
like,
a very different way in her store than yours, I'm sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
We've resolved to.
That's a hard habit to get out of.
Oh.
Putting a hand up. Yes, hello.
Yeah, she moves through, and then I move through afterwards and counsel the staff. So, but anyway, we've reached a point now where she does know how to behave, and we're not bullying people. So,
amazing. How important is it for you to preserve your family story and share it with the community? Because you've actually got it printed up and put, you know, at the counter in your restaurant.
Well, I think we have that family story, so it is an authentic experience of what we've done as a family. And I think it's significant, because it's still grandma's recipes that we've used from way back then. So, it's in every way it's authentic, and we want to run a very authentic business that looks after its staff, and you know, so we, to the nth degree, we agree on the way that people behave and how we behave to each other, and our values are very clear around how we, you know, deal with, you know, food waste and how we deal with customers and how we deal with each other. So so it extends even beyond that. So I think for the staff, it's always good to be connected to something that is bigger than yourself, and you know, and for us, that story really grounds us back to who we are and the business and how far the family's journey has come, and also to be grateful for everything that we have.
Before we wrap up, you brought to my attention earlier on that you have a bit of a video project as well. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about your audiovisual stuff?
Yeah, well, so we run a couple of companies, but in my corporate life, I work out on a company called Beyond Edge, and that does e-learning. It teaches corporates on how to train certain skills to a large audience. So, to say you're a company like CSIRO, you would have a particular training need, and you know, we would produce that into an e-delivered modules. Interactive experience. Yeah. So that's that company. But an interesting project that we got involved in recently was we funded a TV series called Sexy Herpes.
Right.
strange name. I know. We settled on that.
It's only strange if it has nothing to do with the actual content video series.
There is some context, luckily. It's about a sexual health clinic, a regional sexual health clinic.
Right.
And it's a response to the increased rates of STIs and STDs that are happening because the young people think that
I'll be cool.
Yeah,
it'll work out. Just,
yeah,
there'll be a cure.
And it's certainly increasing the instances. So what we're doing is providing a different platform for communicating with an audience about that specific younger skewed audience. Mm. And so it's a web series. It's centered around sort of a sexual health clinic. The main character is lesbian. The receptionist is transgender, or actually gender fluid. So it explores really interesting issues around sexual identity as well as disease and, you know, what that means and, you know, destigmatizing, you know, disease. So
things that aren't always getting spoken about in rural areas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so luckily we got some Screen Oz funding, Screen Australia, thank you. And that's helped us do some completion funding. And we just got critical acclaim from a couple of webfests internationally.
Oh,
so
wow.
Hopefully that comes through.
We're keeping our fingers crossed.
What the bigger term vision is that we want to see it be a TV show that is more mainstream.
Yeah.
So we're negotiating with a couple of TV stations.
Brilliant.
At the moment. Yeah. So that's all happening. So it's
busy.
It's fun. Yeah.
It's still time for baguettes.
Still time for banh mi. I'm still down there. You know, whenever I'm available, I would, you know, go down and serve customers because that's the best way to connect with people. Yeah.
I do have one more favor to ask though.
Yeah.
Can you open one in Deer Park? Because I might be moving.
Well, you know, Sunshine and St. Albans isn't that far away.
There you go. That's true. It is.
Yeah.
All right, T, thanks so much for joining us on Asian Pop Radio.
Lovely to meet you.
You've just heard an Asian Pop Radio podcast. Hear more by subscribing to Asian Pop Radio on iTunes or head to asianpopradio.com to see more.